I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And I'm Dablina Chakraborty.
And we're picking off where we left off on illustrator and naturalist John James Audubon. And in the last episode, we covered Audubon's illegitimate birth to a French ship's captain and his mistress in what is now Haiti, right before the Haitian Revolution. And after making it through the French Revolution as well, John James was finally moved by his father to Pennsylvania in order to avoid conscription in Napoleon's army.
And it's at that point that Audubon really became kind of an early American Renaissance man, someone who was equally at home dancing, fencing, and dressing in fine clothes, lying in brush for hours watching and sketching birds, or studying up on ornithology in the natural world. But it wasn't until 1819, after he'd lost his business in the panic, that Audubon began focusing in earnest on a monumental project, and that was illustrating all of the birds in all of America. We'll include portions of an interview, as we mentioned before, with Michael Inman in this episode. He's the curator of the Rare Books Division at the New York Public Library, who, in addition to being a big Audubon buff himself, shared lots of interesting information with us about the book.
So by 1824, where we left off, after years of sketching birds and traveling around the country looking for new species, John James Audubon was finally ready to find a publisher. And so his wife and two sons had set up their home base near New Orleans, where the boys could be educated and Lucy could teach deportment and piano to the children of wealthy planters there. But Audubon decided that Philadelphia, which was still at that time the intellectual and cultural capital of the United States, would be the best place for him to drum up some interest in this project of his.
And it's important to remember that as beautiful as Audubon's drawings still are today, they must have seemed completely novel and breathtaking at the time, maybe even shocking to some people. When Audubon presented his portfolio to Charles Lucien Bonaparte, who was a member of the Academy of Natural Sciences and Napoleon's nephew, Bonaparte was just blown away by them. and he started parading Audubon around town to meet artists and scientists. And Audubon had this kind of rugged, brash way about him. He'd really cultivated that frontiersman image that we talked about in the first part of this podcast. So he probably surprised a lot of people that he met, but his big mistake was starting to criticize American ornithology, and specifically the late Alexander Wilson and his works, who Michael Inman mentioned Wilson a little bit in the last podcast.
Yeah, and according to William Souter in American History, Wilson's earlier incomplete attempt to illustrate the birds of America, you know, this was something he had tried before Audubon was trying. His attempt at doing that was something that the folks in Philadelphia were really very proud of, and they considered Wilson to be the father of American ornithology, and they considered his book as one of America's first great scientific works, plus just a really nice book. So here comes Backwoods Audubon out of nowhere criticizing Wilson, talking about mistakes in Wilson's drawings, and even accusing him of kind of a type of bird hunting plagiarism. He said that when they met back in Kentucky, he helped Wilson bag a type of warbler that he was searching for and didn't get any credit for that. So instead of finding a publisher in Philadelphia with all of this talk, Audubon found himself shut out instead, shut out of society. Michael Inman actually described it to us as him being, quote, roundly snubbed. But it became clear to him that Europe was just going to be the better place to go. There would be fewer Wilson fans there, so he was less likely to offend people. There would be more people with deep book-buying pockets. And most importantly, there wouldn't be real-life North American birds to just look at in your backyard. So you might be more inclined to buy this very expensive work he was planning.
So Audubon set off for Liverpool in 1826 with letters of introduction and his portfolio in tow. And according to Richard Rhodes in Smithsonian Magazine, one of these letters of introduction was to Lucy's sister Anne, who'd married an Englishman. He was so rugged looking, though, he knocked at the door and he was actually asked not to call again. So
must
burn.
Have seemed like a pretty unpromising start if your own sister-in-law turns you away.
But that actually wasn't the case. Even though his in-laws didn't receive him with open arms, Audubon's non-in-law connections proved to be a lot more promising. Those same qualities that made him unpopular in Philadelphia made him a huge hit in Great Britain. And Michael told us a little bit more about Audubon's reception abroad.
Almost immediately, he became sort of the toast of English society that season. He was sort of celebrated as this rugged American woodsman, and he did a great deal to try to perpetuate that sort of romantic image. His hair was long and flowing. He sort of looked something probably like Daniel Boone to them, and in fact, the English at that time were very enamored of that romantic ideal of Daniel Boone or of, these sorts of images that would come out of a novel of James Fenimore Cooper, for example, that sort of frontiersman image. And so he played upon that and traded upon it, and he set about showing his images, his drawings and sketches to the leading minds of England at that time, and was embraced. They were shocked because it was unlike anything they had seen, but he didn't encounter that sort of snobbishness, I think, that he had encountered in Philadelphia and throughout the United States, and that probably had something to do with the United States then being a still fairly new country and perhaps a little bit insecure about its place in the world. And in England, they were, of course, far more, had been around a very long time, and so they were perhaps a little bit more receptive to new ideas or ways of depicting the world.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
So with that Daniel Boone, Last of the Mohicans kind of persona to recommend him, Audubon started renting out halls for art shows, started spicing up his lectures by providing entertainment himself. He'd talk about what he had seen in his travels to draw all these birds. He'd lecture in his buckskin costume with his hair greased back with bear fat and just talk about frontier life. He would even imitate birds. He would imitate war calls. He must have been quite a one-man show for these audiences.
Yeah, I guess these audiences had sort of romanticized this version of America that he was representing to them. But in Edinburgh, he also connected with engraver William Lazars, who, despite having several other large projects underway, agreed to take on this really massive task of printing Birds of America. And this would include, it would be an ongoing process as they planned it, with Audubon painting and adding new birds and Lazars engraving them. And Michael told us how Lazars would have gone about engraving the first few drawings and how the book was planned to be released bit by bit. Here's what he had to say.
The basic process of completing the engravings was that someone in the printing shop would trace using tracing paper, essentially, would trace the watercolor, getting the general outlines. And then that tracing paper would then be transferred to the copper plate, and that would be done by basically taking the transfer paper, which had the lead image on it, and it would be rubbed essentially onto the plate. The plate itself would have a wax ground across it, which would pick up enough of the traced image that then someone could then take a burin, which is essentially like a needle, and then trace those lines on the copper plate, scooping out that wax ground only where the lines appear. The plate is then put into an acid bath, and depending on how long the plate is left in the acid bath, that will affect how deeply the acid eats into the plate, and the deeper the acid eats into the plate, the darker the line or the broader the line. So it allows you to achieve a darker image and also vary the width of the line. And it's something that a skilled engraver or someone who's used to working with the medium of etching can do in a very controlled manner. And that was something that Lazar's or the people in his printing shop could do. So Audubon's plan for printing Birds of America was fairly straightforward in the sense that it was done through subscription, which was not uncommon at that time. That was something that was common in the book trade, especially for larger works that promised to be published over a period of years. And Audubon projected at the outset that it would take him about 14 years to finally finish printing Birds of America. And his plan was that he would publish the work by subscription serially, that there would be five numbers or sort of packets of images that would be issued per year with five individual plates per number. There would be one large full-size image typically within that collection of five plates, one medium-size image, and then the last three plates would be smaller birds depicted. So you have one very large stunning image typically and then several smaller images within each packet. The price he estimated for each number was about £140, which would come out to about, in today's money, about £11,000 for the complete printing run. That was the projection, or about $50,000 in 1827 money. That would be roughly, I believe, about $900,000 in today's money. So it promised to be a very large undertaking, both from a financial standpoint and also from a printing standpoint as well.
So Lazar's released about 10 engravings before word got back to Audubon that Lazar's colorist had gone on strike. So these were the people who would hand color every single print. And this, of course, threatened to draw out what was already going to be a lengthy printing process. Plus, Audubon hadn't been 100% satisfied with what he had seen, the work he had seen from Lazar's. And he was worried, too, that Lazar's was working on so many projects and wouldn't be able to dedicate himself fully to this one massive project. So Michael told us a little bit about what happened after Audubon got this news. Here's what he had to say.
Audubon saw very quickly that he needed to find another publisher for Birds of America. And he just almost through happenstance, he had a letter of introduction to a man in London, one of the leading printers and publishers in London, a man named Robert Havell. And he went to see Havell and inquired about the possibility of Havell taking the project over. Havell was, again, very much in favor of doing it because it was such a monumental undertaking, however. He said, you know, I'm so far advanced in age, you know, this is promising to take 14 or so years to do. He said, what I'll agree to do is this. I'll take over the project. I'll oversee the engravers. I can't do it myself, but I'll find someone who can engrave the images up to your standards, and I'll oversee them, and we can continue with the publishing of Birds of America here in London. So Havell set about finding an engraver for Birds of America, and he asked several colleagues. And one of the colleagues said, oh, yes, I know a young man who can do a great job, and brought a sample of this person's work. And Havell said, oh, this is fantastic quality work. You know, this is exactly what I'm looking for. He said, who is this person? He said, well, if you like the work, I think you'll like the person. It's your son, Robert Havell Jr. Robert Havell Jr. and his father had been somewhat estranged for a period of years and hadn't really been in contact too much. But they were able to reconcile very quickly with the prospect of taking on this monumental project. Robert Havell Jr. came back into the fold, began working in his father's shop, and Audubon asked Lazar's to send the first 10 copper plates to Robert Havell, which they retouched and reworked and brought up to the current standard. And they began moving forward from that that point on.
So this partnership with Havel and his son proved especially lucky for Audubon, since Havel was a master of something called aquatint, an engraving technique that allowed for tone gradation. And from a practical side, what this meant was that the colorists hand coloring all of those prints didn't have to achieve shading with their paint. They could do a flat wash, but it also meant a beautiful end product. Michael, who of course works with the book at the New York Public Library, said that aquatint really adds depth and difference between the first 10 plates and the later ones, and that difference is really clear when you look at them side by side.
Okay, so at this point, the Havels were publishing the completed drawings, and Audubon was heading back to America every now and then to keep on locating and keep on painting new birds to add to the collection. But he was also writing his ornithological biography, which was kind of an index to go with the printed book. So an index of all the species mentioned, complete with tall tales and notes on how the birds tasted. We mentioned that in the last episode. And wilderness stories, too, some of which he just completely made up. But Audubon's work in Europe and American cities wasn't over either, because he still had to constantly raise subscriptions and maintain the orders of his clients. So there was a business side as well as the artistic side to it. Subscription, though, did offer some advantages for him, even though it required this constant maintenance.
It did. It provided a steady income stream for a project that ended up costing about $900,000 in modern currency. And it also allowed Audubon to get around laws requiring donations of complete sets to British libraries.
Which would have been a huge loss.
Right. But with subscriptions costing about $1,050 at the time for a complete set, only the very rich could afford these books. Michael told us some of the subscribers included George IV of England, Charles X of France, whose subscription actually got interrupted when he was deposed. The British Museum was another subscriber, the Library of Congress, Daniel Webster, and John Jacob Astor. According to Audubon's notes, there were eventually 161 subscribers, though interestingly, some didn't make it through the entire run, as Michael explains to us here.
There was a financial panic, a depression in 1836, for example, and that most likely put a dent in the subscription when you're forced with, you know, deciding if you want to pay for your land or your home or a book about birds. Probably the book about birds is the first thing to go.
So that was kind of a funny anecdote to this whole subscription story. But you can imagine that with Audubon keeping subscribers interested and overseeing the printing and sketching birds still, too, he didn't really have that much time to spend at home with his family in New Orleans. And especially during the first few years, when he was really still getting the project off the ground and still really the toast of the town, too, doing those lectures in his buckskins. And it's during this time that he and his wife had a misunderstanding, a miscommunication. And he'd been abroad for about 2 years, and he was getting lonely. He wrote to Lucy and asked her to join him in Europe. But somehow or another, their letters got crossed in the mail, and he came away with the impression that she would only leave Louisiana when he was finally rich. Well, she thought he just wasn't interested in her anymore. He was famous now, the toast of the town, like we said, and just didn't want his wife hanging around. So finally, according to Rhodes, Lucy basically wrote, "Come home, we need to talk, we need to figure this out." And so Audubon started this epic trip home.
Yeah, he arrived in Bayou Sara in the middle of the night in November 1829, and he later wrote about wandering through St. Francisville looking for a horse to ride the 15 miles to Lucy's school, but he only found the houses emptied by yellow fever. Finally, he got a horse, and he rode through the night and got to Lucy's school at 6 a.m., but he found her already teaching piano. Here's how he described the scene. "I pronounced her name gently. She saw me, and the next moment I held her in my arms. Her emotion was so great I feared I had acted rashly, but tears relieved our hearts. Once more we were together."
So this is why we think Audubon's story needs to be a movie, this grand romantic scene. And Lucy and Audubon basically didn't separate after that. And as their sons grew up, they joined the family business of producing Birds of America, something that went on for a very long time, not quite as long as Audubon expected, but finally completed publication in 1839 after 12 years. So at this point, Audubon was 53 years old, Birds of America had been his lifelong project. And Michael Inman told us a little bit about what somebody like this was going to do next. And here's what he had to say.
Audubon did not really make any money at all on the initial publication of Birds, on the double elephant folio volume, and that term referring simply to the size of the paper that was used, which was the largest commercially available sized paper that was available at that time. He made virtually no money on that, and so he immediately, in 1839, as publication wound to a close, he began looking for ways to recoup some of his investment, and almost immediately began working on a smaller version of Birds of America, what was known as the Royal Octavo version, which is a much smaller format, book format. And he began printing or having that published within a matter of a few years. They began publishing this Royal Octavo format. And because, number one, it was smaller, and also they used a different printing process. Instead of using etching and engraving and aquatint, they used lithography, which was much easier to a medium that's much easier to work with. They were able to publish it much more cheaply. And he made a good deal of money off of the Royal Octavo version. In fact, enough that he was able to secure his financial future for pretty much the remainder of his life. It made a very large chunk of money for him.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about Comfort Hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
So the family ended up moving to this nice house in New York, and the unstoppable Audubon, or seemingly unstoppable, also started planning a work on the mammals of America. So he spent 3 years on that work, but he was aging rapidly. His eyesight started to fail, and he became senile, and he finally died in 1851. His last lucid words were to invite his visiting brother-in-law to go hunting with him. Lucy lived for many more years after that, eventually running out of money, though. First, she sold off the watercolors and then the copper plates to try to support herself. And according to Souder's article, Audubon had had these sent home after printing was completed, but the ship sank in the New York Harbor. And that destroyed many of the plates, and the others were damaged in an 1845 warehouse fire. The remaining plates Lucy sold were being melted down for scrap metal when the plant manager's son realized what they were and saved the ones that he could. He basically just salvaged whatever was left. In 2002, the Audubon State Park Museum in Kentucky actually struck prints from one of them. So they still work.
They still work. And today, too, I mean, we got to talk about the remaining copies of the book, too. Those $1,050 double elephant copies of Birds of America go for about $8 million, meaning that most of the 120 known complete sets are held by museums and universities and libraries. And I guess we can assume a small number of very wealthy people. But it really makes sense from a physical standpoint, as well as a financial one, that these books are held in institutions considering that they are very large books, ones that would be quite difficult to display in a private home, even a well-appointed private home, I would say. They measure 39.5 inches by 29.5 inches. And Michael told us a little bit about what a book of that size is like and how you have to deal with it. And here's what he had to say.
And each volume weighs over 60 pounds. And I know this from experience that it's very... it's not a good idea to try to lift it by yourself. I did try that one time and spent the next week flat on my back in bed with a herniated disc. It's such a large, bulky work and weighing over 60 pounds that it's something that has to be lifted by two people. And, in fact, it takes two people generally to turn the pages because otherwise you run the risk of the pages beginning to tear or rip down at the binding if you don't turn them in a very controlled, careful manner. The books, though, are generally, because of their size, are generally stored flat. And most libraries, then as now, would generally store the books flat. Storing them in an upright manner puts a lot of stress on the binding because that sewn binding is carrying a lot of weight. So you would want to relieve the binding of that sort of stress. So you would store it flat.
So we started this series on Audubon by talking about the founding of the Audubon Society by George Bird Grinnell. Grinnell did have a connection to Audubon. He had studied with Lucy in her widowhood, but to some folks, the connection between a conservation society and a famous bird hunter might seem surprising. So it's important to remember that while Audubon noted and celebrated the seemingly endless bounty of birds in America, one of his famous journal entries, in fact, describes seeing the sky black with passenger pigeons like an eclipse. He also noted later in his career how things seemed less bountiful, how robbing nests of eggs was unsustainable, and how mass shootings were happening. And some of the birds he painted are now extinct, including the passenger pigeon.
Yeah, and in our interview, Michael Inman suggested that it was Audubon's passion for birds and their habitat that made him the figurehead he is in the natural world. And the PBS documentary we talked about on Audubon suggested that it was that early recognition of loss that made him a conservation figure, you know, realizing before many people did what was really happening and how this just wasn't going to last. But I can also see how Audubon's beautiful drawings served as a great example of what was worth saving and could have helped impress upon, say, the Boston Blue Bloods, who we were mentioning in the earlier episode, who weren't going to see egrets in the Everglades as live birds. It would help impress upon them that the birds themselves were really more beautiful than their feathers and than the hats that were made from their feathers.
Yeah, especially since his paintings were so different than anything else that was around during his time. I mean, some of the paintings of the birds, they really do seem to have a personality, like a kind of life to them. But
they do.
We had one last question of Michael Inman that we wanted to ask. Out of the 435 plates and the 189 species and the 1,065 birds depicted in Birds of America, we wanted to know which was his favorite.
And it's very difficult to pick out one that is my absolute favorite. Usually it's I turn the page and that one I'm looking at is, you know, my favorite. If I had to pick, though, I would say plate number 26, which is the Carolina parakeet, in part because it is one of those birds that's now extinct, and Audubon captured the bird in such a wonderful manner. There are multiple Carolina parakeets in the image, six or seven at least, as I recall, and they're depicted in this vibrant green. It was a bright green parakeet. And it's just a stunning, stunning image. It's so dynamic. There's so much action taking place in that image. And the birds are moving. In certain cases, they're looking directly at you. You really get a sense that you're wandering through a thicket or someplace, a swamp in the Carolinas, and suddenly you move a tree branch, and there they are just right in front of you. It's a really stunning image, and it's very colorful and alive. And I think that overall, that would be my favorite. But again, it's hard. Some of my other favorite ones are for lesser-known species. Some of my favorite images are for birds that are some of the small illustrations. The Carolina parakeet is one of those images that's a full page. But some of the ones that are smaller images that are more delicate in nature, those are some of my favorites too, because the more you look at them, the more you see. A spider dangling on a web that's almost imperceptible, or, the details of the foliage, the flowers in the background. There's so much there to see, and every time you look at Audubon's work, you see something new that you've never noticed before. And to my mind, that's one of the great achievements and hallmarks of Audubon's Birds of America, is that you are always seeing something more every time you look at it.
So it's tough for Michael to pick his favorite bird, and it was for us, too. We actually didn't pick one, but we wanted to invite all of the listeners to email us and let us know what maybe your favorite bird in Birds of America is. And we'd like to know as well, is it because you just like the bird, or is
in
it because
real life?
Exactly, or because you actually appreciate the illustration and that made you change your opinion of it for some reason or another. So write to us. We're at historypodcast@discovery.com. We're also on Facebook, and we're on Twitter at Mistin History.
And we do have an article on the Audubon Society, that society named for this famous illustrator. It's called How the Audubon Society Works. And you can find out a little bit more about the plume hunting, too, and some of the crazy later history of the Audubon Society. The plume hunters took the mission pretty seriously, let's just say that, sometimes stooping to murder. So if you want to check that out, search for the Audubon Society on our website at www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at USPS.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.